It's Friday, January 15th. I'm Stephen Fee, and this is The Pen Pod, a podcast from PEN America. On today's edition, best-selling author George Saunders joins us to discuss his new book, A Swim in a Pond in the Rain. We talk Russian literature, the craft of writing, and the art of fiction. Then, Inauguration Week is coming up just days after an insurrection on Capitol Hill. Our CEO, Suzanne Nossel, navigates tough questions about social media and free speech, threats to the right to protest amid the inauguration, and her latest New York Times piece on the legal definition of incitement. I'm Stephen Fee. All that coming up on the Pen Pod. Best-selling writer George Saunders is the author of 10 books, among them the Man Booker winning Lincoln in the Bardo, and he teaches creative writing at Syracuse University. His newest book, A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, is a book version of sitting in Saunders' classroom, walking us through some of the finest works of Russian short fiction. George Saunders joins me now. Welcome to the Pen Pod.
Thank you for having me, Stephen.
It's a pleasure. So let's talk about this book. It's so unique. It's not just essays about short stories. You actually intersperse these short fiction pieces from Chekhov and Tolstoy with your own analysis and guidance and questions. How did you come to this concept?
Well, I was really just trying to model the classroom setting. I've taught this class for 20 years. And so I imagined that the reader was just a student in the class. And those classes are always directly in response to the text. You know, you read them during the week, and then we come in and we sort of unload on them. So I thought for a while, well, I could just do the essays and ask people to go find the stories, but that seemed not quite right. I had it in mind to be a real kind of a joint project between the two of us. So I wanted you to read the stories, then right away I'm going to talk to you about them.
Yeah, I mean, you subtitle the book, In Which Four Russians Give a Masterclass on Writing, Reading, and Life. Why not a masterclass from George Saunders on writing, reading, and life?
I don't feel confident with that. You know, I the whole idea of mastery is kind of antithetical to the way I approach writing. I think you have to come to everything like a beginner. You know, every story is different. So I really wanted to underscore that idea that the reader and I are going to sit together and we're going to both concentrate on these great stories. And I'll go first, you know, I'll offer my ideas. But hopefully the reader is, you know, in there with me, pushing back a little bit, agreeing, disagreeing. So I wanted to kind of give pride of place to the Russians, who are the real masters. And I'm just kind of like a mechanic running around their beautiful Ferraris.
Right. And you mentioned this is based on a course that you've taught. These four authors, why these four?
Well, in the class, we do, of course, a lot more. We do something like 40 stories, and but it became this kind of Rubik's Cube of saying, okay, we only have so many pages. We want to print the stories, and I want my essays to kind of be shapely as well. You know, I want my essays to kind of do a sort of meta story, you know, in which I'm not repeating myself and is sort of graceful. So these are just really the seven stories that have taught the best over the years. You teach these stories in this semester, and these are the days on which the classroom lights up, you know, and that distinction between teacher and class disappears and everybody's kind of elated. And afterwards, I always felt that at least, you know, three or four of the kids had really been affected by the stories in ways that would make their work better. So these are just sort of the ones that really give off the most heat in the classroom.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the book has a lot of exhortations and prompts. One of them is always be escalating. And I'm wondering, is that advice you give in the classroom? And what does it mean?
Yeah. And it's advice I try to take myself. I mean, I think it's inherent in the story form. You know, if I say once upon a time and then you look ahead and there's only six pages there, you kind of understand that this is an exercise in urgency. So then that implies that if, you know, the story is sort of a gradual series of revelations, basically. It starts off maybe sort of mundane, maybe a little judgmental, even snide sometimes. And then over the pages, compassion opens up. And by the end of the story, you know the character better, you know the author better, you know the world better. So that happens best sort of stepwise, you know, a revelation follows a revelation, which is another way of saying it's always escalating. And when you get to a place in a story where there are no more revelations, you should stop. You know, that's kind of all, according to me, that's kind of implicit in the form. In the same way that with a song, you know, if you have a 30-minute fade out, somebody should have come in and cut the fade out because nothing new is happening within it, something like that. And again, this is all just my kind of, you know, my take on the short story, which the reader is free to disagree with.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, that idea of revelatory, breaking these stories down and showing folks that once those revelations are over, that's the end. You know, I mean, there's something about the form of short fiction, obviously, that's very clear. You know, you understand the progression of a story and you can read it in a sitting and figure all that out. I mean, do you think there's something about the short fiction form that is more appealing right now, you know, while our brains are so distracted by, you know, a second impeachment and a war on Capitol Hill and all the horrible things that are happening outside of our front doors?
I think so. But I also would say, and writing this book reminded me of this, you know, we think of reading a short story as kind of an esoteric, you know, cultural indulgence. But actually, we're kind of writing a short story in our head in every minute that we live. You know, there's all this data coming in, and we're trying to make sense of it. So we're telling it to ourselves in a form of a story. We're looking at other people and we're having an initial understanding of them, which is usually almost by definition too small and reductive. If we have a chance to interact with them or we have a particularly good imagination, our vision of them can expand, ideally to the point where we see them as just us on another day. You know, so a story kind of models that. It also kind of teaches us to do that. And I feel like at this moment, after the events of the last week or so, you know, if we ever thought that storytelling wasn't vital to a culture, we've just been reminded that it is. Because what happened was a bunch of people had false agenda-laden stories injected into their minds, minds that, for whatever reason, weren't very good at distinguishing truth from falsehood. It revved them up. They committed, you know, horrible violence, and now they have to live with the consequences. As opposed to what happens in a short story, which is that somebody concentrates for a long period of time to make their story as truthful and empathetic as possible. Then they export it to us. We've been prepared by years of reading. The story falls on us, and it actually has the effect of waking us up and making us more patient and attentive. You know, so those are two very different modes of storytelling, and I think it's a choice culturally that we have to make. You know, if we want to be a more expansive culture, and stories have always been with us, and the literary short story has always been with us. It's a beautiful form.
Yeah, and these stories in particular, I mean, you know, and from these writers in particular, you know, obviously from a different age and era, and for many of your readers from a different country, you know, why do you think they continue to be so resonant? And what is it that keeps students and readers intrigued?
Yeah. Well, for me, the Russians, there's something about these stories. The Russians seem to assume that stories are little moral ethical machines. They're there to help you figure out how to live. Now, they don't necessarily give you answers on how to live, but they sort of deepen the journey. That seems like a fundamental assumption of the Russian stories. These are also, as you suggested, they're pretty simple. You know, they're almost like parables in some way. So that's nice. That's like having a very simple car to work on if you're a mechanic. You can just see all the parts there and it's easy to talk about them. The other thing I say is in the class, part of the really lovely dynamic is that not everybody loves these stories the first time. You know, some of the students generally don't like them. And that's a great energy to have in a class too, where someone comes in and says, you know, this story strikes me as very dull. Well, that gives us a great chance to interrogate the idea of dullness. What are you talking about when you say dullness? Tell me more. So really, these stories, I think, they tend to get a strong reaction from people, mostly positive, but occasionally negative. But from a teaching perspective, a strong reaction you can really work with. Tepid is not so easy, but if someone comes in all fired up in either direction, you can use that energy and do a kind of judo on it with it.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the beauty of this book. I mean, I just remember being a high school student and a college student and assuming that there was always a right answer. And I feel like the way you present questions in this book, you're pretty clear. Like, there isn't necessarily a right answer. It's the question that you want people to really contend with and have either a strong reaction to.
Absolutely right. And mostly because, you know, I'm teaching this class to a group of really, really talented young writers. We pick six every year from a pool of 600 or 700. So they're so wonderful. And my job is not to tell them the right way to read. My job actually is to sort of like lovingly poke at them so that whatever obstructions and difficulties they're having in their own work get relieved. that's a very different thing than, you know, someone who's a professional critic and is trying to, you know, convey the quote unquote correct version of the story. I'm just trying to use it as sort of a, I don't know how to say it. It's a heat source. You know, I'm trying to get the story to speak to them in some way that jogs them loose from whatever obstruction they're caught in. So that's a kind of a different way. And it really is totally fine with me. I mean, any writing advice that's general is going to be pretty bad. You know, you have to give a specific piece of advice to a specific writer regarding a specific story on a specific day for it to even have a hope of being helpful.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, and just you know, sort of conceptually, you know, how do you, you know, obviously you probably came up with the concept of the book before the pandemic, but in some ways, like, this is kind of the perfect read for the pandemic, right? I mean, I imagine you're teaching remotely and your students are having to contend with their ideas, obviously virtually, and being able to speak with you and speak with their colleagues, but you know, we're often having to tussle with these ideas alone. I mean, in some ways, it feels like kind of the right moment for this book.
I mean, it was inadvertent, but I think so. You know, I had the thought that, I say it in the introduction, that this book was a little strange for me because I think it's difficult in some ways, or at least it's challenging. It takes real equal participation from the reader. And so I do imagine somebody who's, you know, now so tired of this, you know, this quarantining and so over it, saying, okay, I'm going to roll up my sleeves and spend some time with this book, that maybe in my usual act of life, I wouldn't quite have the concentration for. And, you know, also, I feel like this pandemic has been kind of, you know, it's just life, but compressed. The tragedy and a kind of, you know, harshness, also the little heroism and all that, it's all been compressed in this last 11 months. And I think for me, as I was writing the book, it was such a comfort to kind of go back to basic questions and say, okay, after this is done, do I want to live the same way I was living before? You know, what I've got limited time here. What am I trying to do? The Russian stories, for me anyway, are a great focuser of those questions. You come out of them and the world looks new and it looks lovely. And most importantly, you feel that you have responsibilities in the world, you know? So they're very casually political in that way. They energize our political impulses. So I feel really lucky that I accidentally chose to write this book when I did, just for my, you know, selfish reasons.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very nice literary, coincidence. It could come right out of a short story.
Yeah.
Well, George, what are you reading right now?
Well, I tend to read several things at once. So my big project is Don Quixote, which I think I've never finished. So I'm working on that. And then we just got a copy of this book, 7.5 Lessons About the Brain by Lisa Feldman Barrett, which is fascinating. She's a wonderful writer, and she's taking apart all my concepts of how the mind works. And somehow it's dovetailing with this book, because one of the things I was thinking about was what's actually happening to your mind when you read? What's actually happening to your mind when you experience and then judge a work of fiction? What's happening in there when you're writing something? So that, along with Michael Pollan's How to Change Your Mind, these books are really speaking to me. And then the other, I've just got a fresh copy of a book called The Trouble with Language by Rebecca Fischow, who is a former student of mine. Really beautiful, strange, short pieces. And then I'm hoping to go back to Stamp from the Beginning, by Ibram Kendi. It's such a beautiful, I read it a few years ago and it was just a revelation. I think it feels like a good time to revisit that book.
Absolutely. Well, George Saunders is an award-winning author. The book is A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, just out this month. Thank you so much.
Stephen, thank you so much for your wonderful questions.
As we head into inauguration week, it's time to put some tough questions about free speech to our CEO, Suzanne Nossel. This is for our weekly Tough Questions segment, and Suzanne joins me now. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, Stephen.
So, Suzanne, you know, it's been well over a week since the Capitol Hill insurrection. In just that time, Parler has been hobbled, Trump knocked off social media. Meantime, those who voted to overturn democracy are seeing their positions revoked, board memberships taken away, their books being shut down. Are we seeing a silencing of the right, or are we seeing a corrective to a corrosive kind of speech?
Look, I think it's a bit of both.
we have to, in analyzing this, separate out, in my view, deplatforming, if you will, that is justified on the basis of what somebody has said or the harm that they have caused. And then the separate question of whether deplatforming is a good idea in a utilitarian sense, what the consequences will be, will it do more good than harm? You know, the first prong, whether it's justified, you know, I think in virtually all of these instances, they involve private companies that have every right to decide who gets a voice on their platform. Twitter, we know, has parameters and rules. If you violate them, you will be kicked off. And that's happened to neo-Nazis, to white supremacists, to Alex Jones, the conspiracy monger. You know, a platform like Parler is doing business with Amazon, with Google and Apple and their app stores. You know, they have the discretion to decide who they want to be in partnership with. Simon & Schuster, the publisher, you know, can decide that a contract that is signed is not something that it wants to go forward with. They may owe some damages to Josh Hawley, but they're within their rights to do that. And so I don't think there's much question that there's a justification in the sense that, you know, these companies have the discretion to apply their own value judgments to these situations. I do think when it comes to the kind of the consequential question of what happens in the wake of this, that there are a number of things that need to be considered. I mean, in my view, when it came to Twitter and Trump, the calculus changed after the election. I thought before the election, there was more benefit to having the public hear directly these unfiltered, noxious messages from the president. There's some evidence even that some of his most outlandish and incendiary tweets may have hurt him at the polls, that people would say that they thought his Twitter was a detractor to his favorability and to their perceptions of him. And so I think muzzling him during that period, you know, could have allowed him to present a more sort of polished version of himself that might have been more appealing to suburban voters. You know, I think the other issues are really in terms of, you know, what happens if you do cut people off. And, you know, the very existence of Parler, you know, is due in part to a kind of exodus from Twitter and Facebook, some of it forced and some of it voluntary, owing to the nature of incendiary conservative posts and messaging and conspiracy mongering that was taking place on those platforms, much of which migrated to Parler. And in the Parler arena, you know, and that's sort of only one level less visible. There are, you know, all kinds of sort of subterranean platforms and arenas, 4chan and 8chan, where people can exchange messages, they can rally, they can plot, they can purvey conspiracy theories, they can find fellow travelers, and none of that sees the light of day. And so if you believe in a marketplace of ideas and the idea that sunshine is the best disinfectant, then you want those ideas to be contested. You want them to be seen and read by people who will disagree, who will rebut, who will, you know, bring to bear facts to counteract a falsehood. And in these kind of shadowy fora, that doesn't happen. It's a purely self-selected group that agrees and that just riles itself up and can become more and more extreme. So that's one risk that comes from kicking people off mainstream platforms. Another is sort of fueling this sense of righteous indignation that seems, you know, so sort of sanctimonious and baseless when you hear people like Josh Hawley, who has a Yale law degree, complaining that his First Amendment rights are being violated when a private publisher rescinds their intention to publish his book. It's just purely specious. And yet, you know, we have seen that this, you know, these cries of cancel culture and the sense of grievance that certain voices are being shut down and excluded and drowned out, you know, is a potent message that the right uses again and again to rally support. And there are people who, you know, believe that this is an outrage and that, you know, even if they may not agree with everything that a Trump or a Josh Hawley says, you know, the minute they're being silenced or shut down, you know, damn it, you know, that's something that worries me. That may be something that, you know, not me, but that's something that worries some of their supporters and that may motivate them to, you know, even more staunchly stand by their side. And so, you know, these are all things that need to be factored in when you ask the question of whether we should be shutting people out of platforms or shutting platforms down entirely.
You know, Suzanne, we're heading into the inauguration, obviously, next week, and there was a clear security threat in Washington. And so we're seeing now, military and law enforcement all teaming up to make sure that the Capitol is safe. At the same time, there's concern that there's overcorrection that could be happening as well, that we could be stifling folks' ability to organize and to protest under the protections of the First Amendment. Do you think that's a threat?
Look, I think they're both things to be concerned about. I think that those organizing the inauguration are right to be on absolute red alert when it comes to security. You know, we know that there have been threats, not just in Washington, but in state capitals. And so that's a very valid concern. I think it's extremely important for the country that the inauguration, you know, go forward and be uneventful and a peaceful transition of power. So I think that's job one. You know, I understand that there have been numerous dozens of protest permits that have been granted in Washington, D.C. And I think strict policing, you know, there's nothing wrong with, you know, requiring that people go through metal detectors, that they not be allowed to bring things with them, that they stay in a certain area that may be, you know, quite far away from the inauguration. Those kinds of time, place and manner restrictions are lawful and appropriate as long as they are applied in a viewpoint neutral way. And you don't have sort of a women's rights group or a pro-Biden group that is given privileged status over a group that may be protesting the inauguration. So I think there is a way to do it to ensure that rights of assembly are protected, but the inauguration is kept safe and secure.
Right. Well, finally, Suzanne, you know, there's been, we published this week on our website an explainer of sorts about the different terminology that's being used around free speech and free expression and the insurrection that we saw on Capitol Hill last week. And one of the terms that gets thrown around a lot is incitement and incitement to violence. And you actually have a piece in the New York Times this week arguing that, you know, President Trump's rhetoric doesn't quite meet the legal definition of incitement to violence. And I'm wondering, why is it that that definition is so narrow? And do you think that poses any hurdles as impeachment proceedings get underway?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, incitement is an issue that I have had occasion to focus on for some time. It really goes back to my work years ago at the U.S. State Department when there was an international negotiation about the freedom of religion and defamation of religion, attacks on people on the basis of their religion, and a view that incendiary content about religion, things like the Danish cartoons of the Muslim prophet Muhammad, constituted incitement to violence. And as the United States, we were always in those debates very forceful about our narrow legal standard for incitement, which is much more speech protective than the operative legal approach in the rest of the world. And so we were very proud of this narrow approach to incitement as protective of free speech. And so it was important to me to emphasize in the context of the impeachment that even though we're using the word incitement, the concept of incitement, which is, you know, a colloquial notion that we all know, it's about sort of goading people into action. And you know, people think Trump has been inciting for the last 4 years, but actually under the law, the only category of incitement that is recognized as an exception to the protection of the First Amendment is incitement to imminent violence. And there's a three-part test that you have to satisfy for that. And so my concern in the op-ed is to ensure that nothing that is said or done in the course of the impeachment process loosen or water down that standard, because it's a standard that applies to people who organize civil rights marches or Black Lives Matter protests or immigrants' rights protests or, you know, mobilizations on a whole range of issues and who need the freedom to be able to rile other people up, to speak forcefully and emotively without worrying that they they may be caught up in a charge of incitement, as Deray McKesson, the Black Lives Matter leader, has been now for more than 4 years. So I think it doesn't by any means stand in the way of impeachment. You know, the standard for impeachment, treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors is intentionally broad. I think the framers of the Constitution recognize that they couldn't anticipate every scenario in which, a future Congress, centuries later might see the need to oust a sitting president. And so, there is notice that certain voices are being shut down and excluded and drowned out, is a potent message that the right uses again and again to rally support. And there are people who, believe that this is an outrage, and that, even if they may not agree with everything that a Trump or a Josh Hawley says, the minute they're being silenced or shut down, damn it, that's something that worries me. That may be something that, that's something that worries some of their supporters, and that may motivate them to, even more staunchly stand by their side. And so, these are all things that need to be factored in when you ask the question of whether we should be shutting people out of platforms or shutting platforms down entirely.
All right. Suzanne Nossel is CEO of PEN America. She's author of Dare to Speak, Defending Free Speech for All. Thanks a lot, Suzanne.
Thank you.
And that's our episode for Friday, January 15. Join us next week for the Pen Pod. You can listen to all our episodes at pen.org. Follow us at Pen America on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I'm Stephen Fee for Pen America. This is the Pen Pod. See you soon.